Low-wage workers face many challenges. Finding affordable housing is a big one.
Even in smaller cities like Springfield or Decatur or Champaign or rural parts of Illinois, nowhere is the minimum wage going to get you the rent on a two-bedroom apartment or even a one-bedroom.
You might have to sacrifice things that you really need, basic necessities, just to make sure you have somewhere to lay your head.
Today we ask, could increasing the minimum wage in Illinois to $15 an hour help? Plus, what do you get when you combine yoga with baby goats?
Baby goats are called kids, and they are really just kidding around. It's a nice, lighthearted, playful quality that they bring to the practice.
Goat yoga, it's a thing, and you can now find it in central Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're working minimum wage, there isn't actually any city in Illinois where you can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. That's according to a new report that was jointly released by the National Low Income Housing Coalition and Housing Action Illinois, which is based in Chicago. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about that report and discuss what difference increasing the minimum wage could have on affordability for housing across Illinois. But first, joining us on the line from Chicago is Brittany Turner. She's had firsthand experience with the challenges of working minimum wage jobs and trying to find affordable housing. Brittany, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Brittany, I know that you have had periods of your life, particularly for between 2009 and 2014, where at various times you were homeless while you were in school and working and raising a new baby. I assume that you were working, but what your jobs weren't able to cover your rent?
Absolutely not. To expound upon what you were saying, during my last 2 years of college, I was working a part-time job. And, of course, when you work part-time, you're not getting enough hours. And I had to pick up a second part-time job just to be able to afford a studio apartment on the south side of Chicago, paying a mere $510 a month for rent. So out here, the stipulations are you have to make 2.5 to 3 times the rent. A lot of places are cracking down and making it 3 times the rent in order to even lease to applicants. And I was barely able to lease a studio for $510 with 2 part-time jobs that put me well over 40 hours a week.
So how much were you, working 2 part-time jobs, you were working well over 40 hours a week. What kind of work were you doing and how much money were you making?
I was a cashier at Potbelly's and I was making $8.25, and then I picked up a second part-time job working $9 an hour, and I used to get between 10 to 15 hours a week. Sometimes they would offer more hours depending on first come, first serve basis. My second part-time job I picked up was at the NORC as like a telephone interviewer.
Wow. And you were doing that while you were also still in school?
Yes.
And you had a new baby?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And you also said, by the way, you were making $9 an hour. So I want to point out, you were actually making more than the minimum wage because...
For the NORC, but even though I was making $9 an hour, they were only really able to offer a certain amount of hours a week.
Okay, which is something that I think we're going to talk about this in a few minutes. I think that's a pretty common thing where you're trying to patch together all of these part-time jobs. And then you said you had a hard time with the apartment. You were renting an apartment. You said on the south side of Chicago for $500 a month?
Yes, this was like the cheapest apartment I could find through Pangea, and they had a studio apartment for $510 a month. They barely were going to lease it to me, but I ended up being able to work more hours just to be able to get an apartment to prevent myself and my child from not having a place to stay.
What was the apartment like, Brittany?
Well, being that it wasn't, it didn't cost very much to rent. You get what you pay for. So The location of the unit was in a really bad area. There was a lot of violence, gang activity, a lot of robberies in the area. Sometimes I would come home from work and they would be shooting at the building. I wouldn't be able to come home. It was roach infested. Sometimes I had to deal with things that affected my other tenants. There was a lot of different characters that stayed in the units as well as lingered outside of the apartment buildings. It was a difficult experience living there, in addition to just being able to actually get a unit. So it wasn't necessarily easy after I was able to receive housing.
And for you, did you qualify at the time also for any other public assistance help with your housing?
I did. Unfortunately, there was so many wait lists. A lot of times I would get on a wait list, and I do remember being called like a year and a half later for one, and then sometimes I never would receive a call for some of the other subsidized units that I applied for.
And Brittany, I imagine this sounds like terrible, the apartment that you're describing. I imagine that was still an improvement over the times that you went through periods where you were actually homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you, how did you handle that in terms of your baby as well? Was that something where you were in different shelters? How did you handle that?
On two different occasions, I had to go to two shelters, one on the west side, one on the south side of Chicago. And it was definitely mentally and emotionally exhausting, because the experiences at shelters, people think that you can bathe and eat and they'll provide for you, but it's the exact opposite. Like, I was pretty shocked to learn myself that sometimes they don't even provide you with food. Sometimes you can't bathe, and they often treat you as if you're like an inmate or like you're in a halfway house, so you don't get treated fairly or nicely even when you do go to a shelter.
I mean, Brittany, I know this has been a really long journey for you. And now, you know, for the past 2 years, I know you've had a steady job. You've been working full time for about 2 years and you finished school?
Yes, I graduated in 2013. It was
Congratulations.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was very difficult. I jokingly tell other people I don't know how I did it, because there was just so much going on at the time. But I was able to, after jumping around through temp agencies, to find stable employment. And since then, I constantly was able to move to try to find a peace of mind as far as housing stability.
Yeah, I want to bring someone else to this conversation. We've been speaking with Brittany Turner. She's been sharing her story about her struggles with housing affordability while working two jobs, as she said. Bob Palmer is the policy director of Housing Action Illinois. I mentioned that report at the beginning of our conversation. Bob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
As you're listening to Brittany's story, Bob, I wonder if you can give us a sense of how common these struggles are, not just in Chicago, but across Illinois.
Well, unfortunately, it's very common. And in the Out of Reach report that we released recently, we found, and again, this is an average for the state, that you have to earn $20.87 per hour to afford the rent on the average two-bedroom apartment without paying more than 30% of your income on housing, which is sort of the generally understood guideline. And if you're paying more than 30% of your income on housing, you have affordability problem. And if you are an extremely low-income household, if you are fortunate enough to have housing, probably you're spending well in excess of 30% of your income on housing, sometimes even more than 50%, which just leaves very little for food, education, the other costs of living, and puts you really at risk of homelessness.
Brittany, what percentage of your rent do you, what percentage of your income do you spend on housing, both when you were in that $500 apartment and now?
I do believe that the reason they didn't want to lease me a unit was because it was more than 30% of my income.
Right.
And currently I'm just at 30% of paying for rent as of now with a full-time job. But before, I do believe the rent used to take up a large portion of my income.
Yeah. And I mean, I wonder if you can give us a sense of how tough that is to juggle when you have all of these other needs. You had school, you have you have a family that you're trying to provide for, and then obviously the roof over your head is probably first priority, but I imagine you had to make a lot of other sacrifices, you know?
Absolutely. I think especially if you're a person who's dealt with homelessness, you'll pay your rent and might have to sacrifice that you might not have enough money to pay your utilities. You might have to pay your utilities late, or you might have to, your phone might be off, or you might have to sacrifice things that you really need, basic necessities, just to make sure you have somewhere to lay your head.
Yeah. Bob, if you look at the report, basically, if you look at the numbers, basically, a person would have to work 2.5 full-time jobs to afford a two-bedroom apartment at the market rate. That's all across Illinois, correct? That's not just in Chicago?
That's all across Illinois, yes. So it does range across the state, and even in, you know, the most expensive part of the state, which is the Chicago metropolitan area in general, you have to earn $23.69 per hour to afford the rent on an average apartment. But even in, smaller cities like Springfield or Decatur or Champaign or rural parts of Illinois, nowhere is the minimum wage going to get you the rent on a two-bedroom apartment or even a one-bedroom apartment. And I think as Brittany's story exemplified, you know, so many minimum wage jobs are not full-time. And so our study is based on the assumption, which doesn't happen very often, that you're working 40 hours a week and you're working every week of the year. And so if you take and consider all the part-time workers, you know, the housing wage would be even higher.
We are going to tweet out a graphic that Bob was just talking about, just under $24 an hour in Chicago, that ranges to $13 to $18 an hour in Rockford. We'll have all of those stats from that report if you follow our handle 21STShow. We'll put that online as well so you can see the rates per city. And I think that is the point, Bob, right, that these reports do assume a 40-hour minimum wage job. And how common is that? How much more common is it from a labor market perspective that people are working two or three part-time jobs and trying to cobble all of that together?
Well, the report itself doesn't address that, but I know anecdotally from talking to people around the state struggling for housing that many minimum wage jobs are not full-time, and also, you know, they often don't have any benefits, so people are paying for health care and other stuff out of pocket that people with higher jobs, especially if you're earning a salary that is included in your employment compensation.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, overall, how does Illinois rank compared to other states when it comes to affordable housing?
Nationally, we have the 16th highest housing wage, according to the report that we just released, and that is the highest in the Midwest. That's pretty consistent. We do this report every year, and it's been pretty consistent from year to year where we rank.
Brittany, as you're listening to all of this, what do you want people to know about the challenges with finding affordable housing, apart from what you've already shared with us about your story?
I think that people should be sensitive and not think that people who don't have the means to do it, that they don't work hard for it, and that it's just a stereotype that people think because you don't have anything to show for as far as financially that you don't work really hard to get there. Like, I think a general stereotype is that people who are poor don't work or they're lazy, and the truth is you'll find that people, the most overworked people, the people who work very hard are the people who often might not have much to show for it.
Mm-hmm. And have you been able to move now? Are you in a better neighborhood now? You're out of that apartment?
I've moved, I want to say, between 4 to 6 times in the past 3 to 4 years due to just a lot of poor housing. What's available in the city of Chicago is very hard to find quality apartments. A lot of times you run across slumlords. A lot of times you run across, okay, now I can afford this unit, but I have a bad landlord, or now you're subjecting yourself to other issues, like the neighborhood might not be ideal and you really can't afford to move near the Loop or where it's actually a good apartment because it costs a lot of money. Like, you have to pick and choose your battles. Like, do I want to be in a safe environment and pay $1,300 a month, which most people really can't afford that either, or do I want to sacrifice paying a lot of money just to feel comfortable, or do I want to pay less and put myself in danger? So it's sometimes you just have to pick and choose based on how much money you make, what you can afford, and sometimes you really do have to pay for a peace of mind.
Well, Brittany, I wish you the best of luck. Again, I thank you for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it. That's Brittany Turner. Brittany, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bob Palmer. We're going to bring a few more folks into it as we look at the cost of housing affordability across Illinois when you're working a minimum wage job. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the issue of minimum wage and housing affordability. According to a new report out, if you were working at minimum wage, you'd have to hold down 2.5 jobs to be able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment. That's anywhere in Illinois. That's not just in Chicago. That report was jointly released by the National Low Income Housing Coalition and Housing Action Illinois, which is based in Chicago. Bob Palmer's on the line with us. He's the policy director of Housing Action Illinois. And I want to bring two more people into this conversation. Two of the co-authors of another recent report that was published in October of last year, looking at the impact increasing the minimum wage is likely to have on housing affordability. Bob Bruno is a professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Lauren Nolan is formerly an economic development planner with the Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Improvement at UIC as well. Both Bobs, Lauren, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
So I wondered, Bob Palmer, just to follow up on what Brittany was saying and just to go through these numbers again, your report found a significant difference in the amount that you have to make in order to afford rent in an urban versus rural area. And I think people might think, okay, that's a no-brainer, but they might think in maybe more rural areas that people could still afford, if you're working at a minimum wage, you still could afford, say, a 2-bedroom apartment. Is that the case?
It's not. Even in the parts of Illinois that are not within a metropolitan area that are rural, essentially the housing wage is still $12.92 an hour. And again, that's assuming you're working 40 hours a week, which so many minimum wage jobs do not provide. So there is still lack of affordable housing all over the state that's well in, and you have to earn well in excess of the minimum wage to afford housing.
Mm-hmm. Bob Bruno, I wanted to ask you from a labor market perspective also, if you can give us a sense of people who are working at a minimum wage. Brittany said she was working, she was pulling together a couple of jobs, actually making a little above the minimum wage. One place she was making $9 an hour in the Chicago area. What do we know about minimum wage workers in terms of how much on average they're able to work, how many jobs they're often working? Is it often part-time work that's being pieced together?
Brittany's story was very typical. A number of studies, including one that we did here at the University of Illinois, looking at fast food workers in the Chicago area, really found that these workers were looking at two jobs, trying to find three jobs, trying to cobble together enough hours. Most were not teenagers, right? These weren't just first starter jobs. Over a third were raising families and had been in the field or working these low-wage jobs for a number of years. And the hours that they worked just fluctuated significantly. And it was necessary to sort of constantly be available for work. Many would try to go to school, as Brittany was attempting, and she seems to have actually succeeded, where many just indicate, you know, we can't do it because we don't essentially have the scheduling stability in order to balance work and family. So it's a very common story, and not just in fast food, but really across many industries in Chicago and in a number of different regions around the state. So it's all too painfully familiar.
Lauren, there's also often a stereotype that minimum wage workers are teenagers who are working high school jobs. Do you think that is a stereotype? Does that reflect the reality of what we see of the profile of minimum wage workers, particularly in Illinois?
That definitely does not reflect the typical minimum wage worker. Our study shows that over 90% of folks that are working minimum wage jobs are not teenagers. In fact, as Bob mentioned, two-thirds are over the age of 24 and are raising families on minimum wage jobs.
And I think when we think about the idea of raising the minimum wage, Lauren, obviously we're looking at the Illinois General Assembly passing legislation that would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. We know the city of Chicago has taken steps. That statewide, that measure is now to Governor Rauner. He's being lobbied pretty hard by labor and other groups to sign the bill. How much would raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, based on your research, how much would that help make housing more affordable for people who are currently struggling?
It would make a substantial impact. When we started to do this research and actually identify which workers would be impacted and how much they're currently paying for housing and how much more they would now be able to afford their housing, we figured there would be an impact, but I was surprised as a researcher to figure out how big the impact actually was, not just in regions like Chicago where the housing costs are the highest, but actually statewide. There is a substantial impact to raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Okay. And when we think about the labor market in general, Bob Bruno, I wonder what people say. You know, there's always sort of the arguments about minimum wage and businesses. In a moment, we're actually going to talk to a couple small business owners who are actually for increasing the minimum wage. But I wonder if you could just give us a sense, Bob, of the labor market right now in Illinois. Is it something where are we seeing wages rising just at a natural rate? What does our wage rate look like in Illinois compared to other parts of the Midwest?
You have to sort of parse out parts of the state, of course. Chicago, by comparison to other cities in the Midwest, is actually doing, you know, pretty well. But overall, wage growth, you know, is really barely at the consumer price index, and that's been under 1%. So, you know, it's not as if there's this hot labor market that is just driving demand for workers and naturally or through the marketplace raising incomes. Now, there are parts of the country like Seattle, for example, that have seen a real hot labor market, and average wages have been pushed up. But interesting enough, they've also passed a $15 an hour minimum wage that is incrementally introduced. There's a great need for using public policy as a way to try to raise the floor, the income floor, and where you've seen these minimum wage increases passed across the country, and there have been many of them, they have in fact had a significant impact on millions of workers without, interestingly enough, really having much statistical impact on the total number of jobs, both in these industries and in industries that are paying slightly above the minimum wage. So, I mean, certainly Illinois could use a stimulant public policy for raising incomes.
And Bob Bruno, it seems obvious that increasing wages would make housing more affordable for someone who's particularly at a low wage rate. Would you expect that there are other factors that might say actually it wouldn't help that much?
So it depends on how much we're raising this income and what are the other variables that could be driving housing cost, what the impact might be on other forms of social service, entitlements, housing vouchers that typically low-wage workers have to cobble together. Lauren may be in a position to sort of speak more directly about some of those other drivers. But if all we did was raise the minimum wage to $15, which by the way is certainly a real increase for workers that has dramatic impact for those workers and for the state's overall economy, we're still not talking about really what some economists would call a real livable wage. So it would not eliminate the need for other kinds of social support for the lowest wage earners, but it most certainly would improve the economic standing of these workers, and in fact would, as our studies show, lower that housing burden, particularly if you got to $15, by a considerable amount. And the impact would be very real.
That's Bob Bruno. He's a director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Lauren Nolan, before we get to your to what Bob Bruno was asking you about, Bob Palmer, Policy Director of Housing Action Illinois, can I ask, when we looked at your numbers from your report, in fact, $15 an hour would only help maybe in some cities, like that might help in maybe Rockford or Peoria or Bloomington-Normal. It would barely help, for example, in Champaign-Urbana, and it certainly would not help in Chicago. Bob Palmer, I imagine that has to do with the cost of housing. That has to do with, and have we seen housing costs rising faster than wage rates in Illinois?
We have in, tighter, historically more expensive rental markets that even when, wages have been relatively flat, because more people are renting in the aftermath, the foreclosure crisis is one of the big factors. We have seen rents continue to go up, and that's been at the high end of the market, but also at the low end of the market where people have the greatest affordability problems. And, considering that the minimum wage is, at this point, is only $8.25, even though it wouldn't solve the whole problem, we'd still see the, increasing the minimum wage as making a significant impact on housing affordability.
If you looked around the state, for example, take the Peoria region, our study found that over 36% of the workers were earning under $15 an hour. In the Quad Cities, it was over 40%, and in the Rockford region, it approached 50%. So, there are parts of the state where there are such high percentage of workers who are earning under that $15 that a $15 bump would impact significant numbers of people. It might not get them, to the housing affordable, all up to the housing affordability point, but that would be a really substantial increase in earnings for that workforce.
Lauren Nolan, I wanted to also ask you, as we talk about this, back to Bob Bruno's original point about apart from just wage raises, we heard Brittany say she didn't qualify for different there was different public assistance programs she didn't qualify for, actually because she was working so much that put her out of qualification. And we also heard her say that she was waiting very long on waiting lists. We've heard the stories in Chicago of people waiting years for housing. You guys have looked about this, right? Like in terms of people, what role do we think government subsidies and other programs play in this situation?
I will say it's very difficult and nearly impossible in the data to actually link folks that are recipients of public assistance to what their housing costs are and what their wage rates are. So it's difficult to make that to draw those lines completely. But we did make some estimates to understand what the impact would be on use of public assistance. And there's a couple things going on here based on our estimates. First, low-wage workers use public assistance obviously at a higher rate because their need is much higher, right? So if we are able to increase their wages, that might decrease their reliance on state and federal programs, which might free up other resources for other folks. Because as you mentioned, the wait list for a housing choice voucher in Illinois and in Chicago in particular is exorbitantly long. It's very challenging to get any kind of assistance through that Housing Choice Voucher program. That being said, it's important to understand if you now become ineligible for those benefits, you might have a wash or a zero-sum gain if you even are seeing a wage increase. It's important to understand, yes, your take-home wage might be higher, but that might make you ineligible for things that are very important and challenging, like, say, child care assistance subsidies. So it's important to understand there's a lot of moving parts here and a lot of ways that I think it's important to support low-wage workers beyond just increasing the minimum wage.
Lauren, what impact did you find in your report about increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour in Illinois, specifically on housing affordability?
So increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour would substantially impact housing affordability in Illinois. Looking at renters, 114,000 more households in Illinois who are renters would now be able to afford their housing, meaning they'd be now devoting 30% or less towards their housing costs, which is that benchmark for affordability. On the ownership side, and again, low-income workers tend to be low-wage workers tend to be renters, but there are homeowners that are having trouble paying their mortgages. So increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour would mean that 56,000 more owner households would now be able to better afford their mortgage payments and be under that threshold for housing affordability.
Bob Palmer, I will let you have the last word here in terms of what you think the takeaway should be for people who are listening to this. Obviously, it's a complex issue, the issue of affordable housing in Illinois. But when we think about minimum wage, I wonder how you want people to think about the role that minimum wage plays in helping make housing more affordable for people who are working full time and still trying to afford a safe place to live.
Well, the data consistently shows that if you are an extremely low-income household, let's say a family of four that's earning $24,000 a year or less to afford the rent, you're very likely paying, you know, in excess of 50% of your income on housing. So increasing your wage, even if it doesn't get you down to totally an affordable level, but even if you go for example, paying 60% of your income on housing, going down to 35%, that is going to make your life so much less stressful. If you have children, you'll be in a better position to parent them and, you know, ensure that they do well in school. So, you know, kind of think about your current life, and if you're paying 60% of your income on housing, you know, what would that mean for you? And most every extremely low-income person in Illinois is living that reality, which is why we need to raise the minimum wage.
That's Bob Palmer. He's Policy Director with Housing Action Illinois. I want to thank Bob Bruno as well, who directs the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois, and Lauren Nolan, formerly Economic Development Planner with the Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Improvement at UIC. Bob, Lauren, Bob, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll speak with small business owners about a position that might surprise you. They support increasing the legislation that passed the Illinois House and Senate to increase the state minimum wage to $15 an hour because they think it would be good for both workers and businesses. As a reminder, you can always follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. During the program, we live tweet with more context and analysis. We're doing that right now with stuff about minimum wage. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We've been talking about affordable housing and how increasing minimum wage could help low-wage workers afford housing. And when we talk about increasing the minimum wage, critics often raise concerns about the negative impact that'll have on small businesses. But not all small business owners are worried. In fact, the owners of the Chicago restaurant Honey Butter Fried Chicken say they support legislation that would increase Illinois' minimum wage to $15 an hour. Josh Culp and Christine Sikowski join me now on the line from Chicago. Josh, Christine, welcome to The 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Well, can I start by asking, a lot of times people say that one of the businesses are always sort of the ones who are opposed to increasing minimum wage, especially small businesses. Why do you all feel differently?
You know, when we opened Honey Butter, we kind of came at it with the idea that we wanted to build a business with great bones. And for us, that meant making sure that our employees were taken care of just as much as we were sort of putting all this energy and time into thinking about having great fried chicken and great food. We wanted to make sure that we had a great place to work. And for us, that kind of really meant putting our money where our mouth was. We want to be known as having great service. We want to be known for being a very warm, welcoming, inviting place. And what we've kind of found is that making sure that our employees are taken care of, obviously financially and through having benefits like paid sick leave and paid sick time and paid parental leave, we're trying to create a place where our staff is able to perform at a high level and able to kind of succeed, you know, and be able to sort of uphold our company values.
Yeah, Christine, when Josh says that you guys already pay your workers more than the minimum wage, are you paying about $13 an hour right now?
Most of our employees start at $13 an hour.
Okay.
Most of them are actually making above that.
And how many,
We try to give them good opportunities to grow and cross-train into other positions, and when they do that, they're given more responsibility and a pay increase. So most of our employees are actually above 15, but the ones that are starting start at 13.
And how many employees do you guys have?
We have 40 employees.
About 40.
About roughly. Depends on the season. Summer's really busy.
Right. This is the time that everybody's lining up for fried chicken, right? So can I ask, in terms of your workers and your workforce, do you find that how much you're paying is above the prevailing rate for restaurants in the city, or is it about the same? Do you feel like, I'm curious your response to that.
I think we're on the higher end of the range, especially if you take in consideration the amount of restaurants paying the sub-minimum wage for tip workers. But I think that our wages kind of fall in the higher level. We're certainly not paying the highest, but we're up there, and we feel with the benefits that we give, we're actually very competitive with our pay. We have paid time off, paid sick leave, health insurance, and paid parental leave, and also gain sharing. So if you add all that up, I'd say we're very competitive with our wages and benefits.
And Christine, I'm sorry, did you say gain sharing?
Yes, gain sharing. So that's we have a financial plan for our year. We actually do open book management at Honey Butter, which means we share all the financial data of the business with our staff on a weekly basis, and we all analyze it together and sort of make decisions on how we're doing and forecasting into the future. And it's sort of like a financial game that we play with our staff. And if the business does well, and we hit what we call the gain, which is anything above our planned profit, we share a percentage of that with the staff.
And you guys wrote about this, actually, in the Sun-Times. You wrote about how paying your wages has led to several – paying wages, higher these higher wages, all of these other things. Where do you see where do you see the payoff, not to make that pun, but in terms of how much more you're paying financially, where do you see that kind of having an effect on the rest of the workforce in your business?
assists in low turnover. You know, we save money on not having to always be looking for another employee in training. But we also really see it just in terms of the enthusiasm and connection our staff has to the business. I mean, through open book management and gain sharing, you know, our team is really kind of focused on keeping the company healthy. And keeping the company healthy really means that then the company can help provide for them. I think when they know that if they perform well in their job, the company will be healthier, and it's sort of a circular arrangement where they know it's going to come back to them, and their jobs are going to be there.
I was just going to add to that that you know, we kind of have a philosophy here that we treat everyone like a customer, including our staff, like not just our paying customers. We feel like we have a obligation to provide our employees with really, really good service too. And I think them feeling so taken care of and supported here is actually translated into them giving excellent customer service to each other and also our paying customer, which, you know, we have a lot of repeat customers, we have a lot of regulars, and people are always commenting on how great our service is. And I think that that's directly related to how well they're treated.
And then, of course, the big question is how much of this do you end up passing on in terms of, do you feel like you have to charge more for your food in order to support this business model?
There's lots of variables, obviously, in what goes into costing our food. So, you know, we're buying a lot of ingredients from small farmers. We're trying to really serve, obviously, we're serving fried chicken with honey butter on it, but we're trying to use really great chickens, and we're all chefs here and want to put out great products, so that's a factor in it. But what we've seen is that our labor cost percentage is not all that much higher than what we think the sort of industry standard is. And we feel like the prices that we put out are very fair. You know, we have people coming in frequently saying, you know, this place has great service, this place has great food, how do you guys do it? And we really do think that it's because our staff feels good about being here, and they go out and sell our product, and they really are champions of it.
And what would you all say to other small business owners who say they just can't afford to do what you're doing, and that if the minimum wage was $15, it would put them out of business?
I think that that's a really tough thing to answer, because you don't want to make assumptions about, like, you don't want to say to somebody, well, you need to reevaluate your business. You have to sit down and decide what your priorities are and how you want to be in this for the long haul or the short haul. Like, if you want to build a business that has great bones, you're going to have to put in probably more capital in the beginning and working capital and then human capital into your staff. And, you know, you just sort of have to decide that you want to do it and then figure out how to do it. And that might mean that you have to raise your prices. It might mean that you, you know, you have to cut your food costs. You might have to cut other things. And you have to decide what's most important to you, your profits or your employees. And we kind of see both of them as equally important. So we try to make decisions that positively affect both of them.
Neither of us have experience running a business that doesn't do it this way. So, you know, we're asked this question, that question often. But I think as far as we're concerned, we don't know how to run a successful business without treating our, you know, making sure our employees are taken care of. And that's really worked for us. We started that way from day one. We both, on the flip side, do have experience having worked in restaurants and in retail, in businesses that really did not take care of their employees very well. You know, so we know what the other side of that looks like, and we know what that can do for morale and motivation. And, you know, running a restaurant is such a hard thing to do. I can't fathom doing it with a staff of workers who feel like they're unappreciated and not being taken care of.
That's Josh Culp and Christine Sikowski, both of them owners of Honey Butter Fried Chicken, which is in Chicago, in Avondale neighborhood. Josh, Christine, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Many people look to yoga as a physical, mental, and spiritual discipline, and the rising popularity of the practice can be seen in the number of yoga studios and classes that are available across the country. And there's a new craze that is also being added to yoga classes, including a new yoga class in Central Illinois that is unlike a traditional yoga class because it involves goats. Our producer, Christine Herman, went to a recent class and brought us back this audio postcard of what goat yoga is like.
We're We're going to start seated, so most of you are there already. If you'd like to cross your legs, we'll make a little ba to encourage the goats. Traditionally, the om sound, so we'll sing it on exhale. My name is Maggie. I am one of the owners of this farm right behind you, and I'm also a yoga teacher in town.
I don't really love yoga, and this made yoga super enjoyable. I would do everything with goats. They're so cute.
Now step your right foot forward to a lunge again. If you're in the front row, you can see quite easily in this pose the goat doing yoga in the back row. Yeah.
They're much more playful than I thought they would be.
If you've never done yoga and you want to try it, but you're not sure if you would be good at it, this would be a great way to try it and not take yourself too seriously, you know.
And it's beautiful out here.
Yeah, it really is.
Perfect night.
Yeah.
When your hands together in front of your heart, I thank you so much for your attention, although it was distracted.
Thank you so much. Namaste.
That was just a taste of what a Yoga with Goats class has to offer. I'm joined now by the instructor of that class, Maggie Taylor. She's also one of the owners of Delight Flower Farm in Champaign, where the class is taught and where those goats live. By the way, for those who are in the Champaign-Urbana area, Maggie will be teaching a class tonight. We're going to tweet out all of that information and have it available on our website. Maggie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So where did you come up with the idea of combining your farm, where you have goats, with your profession, which is also being a yoga instructor?
Yeah, well, I actually can't take credit for it. I had enough yoga students posting on my Facebook wall goofy videos of people doing yoga with the shenanigans of goats that I thought, oh, you know, this is really something. And since our farm is on property that is a goat farm and creamery, Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery, and they have a bunch of baby goats born every spring, it just was a natural fit and made sense. People want this, so I'll give it a try.
It seems a little counterintuitive, right? Because I like to go to yoga class to normally relax and have quiet and maybe a little darkness. I'm thinking of the yoga studios when I do inside. Does having goats running around, do you think it makes it harder to focus? How are people reacting?
Well, I feel similar to you in that it's definitely not probably my specific location or style of yoga. I tend to be more of a serious practitioner with a lot of focus. But what's been surprising for me and really a positive thing is that because of the known distraction of goats, it seems to be a lot more approachable, accessible class to people that are intimidated by a regular yoga class in a austere studio because there is something to divert people's attention. So I've had a lot of people that have never done yoga before attending these classes, and I think that that's really a good thing, even though it may be a skewed perception of what yoga is like in a public studio.
Well, so it also is, right, it also would be, because in a public studio you also don't have, like, I was talking to the producer, Christine Herman, about, she who did the postcard about how, like, the goats are maybe like smelling your hair or trying to, you know, nibble at you while you're doing downward dog. I was just thinking goats kind of like to bite you or.
You're lucky if they're just smelling you. I think most likely they're going to be trying to eat your water bottle or pee on your mat or something less pleasant than just smelling.
Because all of those things are happening.
Absolutely. But the really positive aspect of that is that, you know, they're so lighthearted. They are, you know, baby goats are called kids and they are really just kidding around. And so you can't bring your stressful life and your intense personality. You can bring it to class, but it's definitely going to break. The goats are going to break down that wall. So it's a nice, lighthearted, playful quality that they bring to the practice.
So now are you going to do this with any other farm animals?
I don't know. I can't really picture a cow climbing on someone's back in down
that
dog.
That would be a little dangerous.
Maybe kitties or puppies or something like that. But at this point, it's just the goats, and we'll see where it goes. We offer other yoga classes on the farm that don't have animals, just a sunrise like experience
just
in
so
nature.
So everyone knows. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's also tranquil and lighthearted and calming. So, yeah.
So So what do you think is, just to ask, I mean, what do you think is behind this? Because this is happening all over the country. What do you think is behind this?
It's puzzling to me. I do not have a good answer for that. I really think, like, wow, what's this combination? Because, I mean, sure, people like goats. They're a farm animal, but they're not as big as a horse or a cow or as dirty as a pig, or our perception of dirty pigs. And yoga, people love yoga. It's a growing trend, as you mentioned, across the country and has been for several decades now. But the combination is just baffling me. I don't really get it.
All right. Well, we don't get it. But if you are intrigued by this and you are in the Champaign-Urbana area, Maggie is teaching a class tonight. We're going to tweet out all of the information and have it at our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Maggie Taylor, who is a yoga instructor and also one of the owners of Delight Flower Farm in Champaign. Maggie, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.